that our interest in these subjects with which we are dealing may not be merely intellectual, but grant that we may realize that we are dealing with thy judgment upon the whole world and thy judgment upon us. And do thou grant that we may realize the gravity of that condemnation that has passed upon all, and of that death with which all are inflicted, because we all sinned in Adam. O Lord, forbid that we should take lightly thy judgment, and that thus we may be prepared for that real heart abiding appreciation of the justification that is in Christ Jesus through his righteousness as the righteousness of the spotless Lamb of God. For his name's sake, amen. Now I have been dealing with this Palladian view of sin, with the good effort of his hematom, and I have come to the third criticism, namely that this Palladian exegesis is in direct contradiction of the repeated affirmations of this passage. And at the close of the hour, I had come to this point that if Paul says that the reign of the condemnation and death proceeds from the one sin of the one man, Adam, then it is impossible at the same time to say that men have come into condemnation and die because of their own natural transgression. And that is precisely what Paul says repeatedly in this passage from verses 15 through 17 through 19. You have that principle repeatedly asserted. By the trespass of the one, the many died. Verse 15. The judgment was from one to condemnation. Verse 16. By the trespass of the one, death reigned through the one. By the trespass of the one, death reigned through the one. Verse 17. Through one trespass, judgment came upon all men unto condemnation. And then, by verse 18, and then, through the disobedience of the one man, the many were constituted sinners. Now do pay attention to these repeated affirmations, stated in different ways, but all leading to this all-important proposition that death and condemnation came to reign over all men, over the whole human race, by the one sin, one man, Adam. You might think that the Apostle Paul had quite needlessly repeated himself. He was guilty of redundancy. But it is just because the apostle was so jealous to establish that thesis of the significance for the whole human race of the one sin, of the one man Adam, that he reiterated that principle in different forms so that it would be absolutely watertight and that the conclusion would be absolutely inescapable. And it is quite impossible, quite impossible to construe this reiterated emphasis upon the one sin of the one man, Adam, as equivalent to the actual personal sins of all men. Impossible to construe as the actual personal sins of all men. Because may I say again what I mentioned yesterday, that the whole emphasis here is upon singularity. But when you are thinking of the personal transgressions of all men, you have in mind plurality, uncountable plurality. Now for the fourth criticism, lowercase woman, that this Pelagian construction is not compatible with the whole structure of this passage. It's not compatible with the governing principle of this whole passage. The structure. The central strand in this passage is the parallelism between the entrance of sin, condemnation, and death, the entrance of righteousness, justification, and life, the parallelism between the way in which sin, condemnation, and death came to reign, and the way that righteousness, justification, and life come to be operated. And in view of that parallelism, there must be an identity of modus operandi Latin phrase which means mode of operation. There must be an identity modus operandi. Otherwise, the analogy couldn't obtain. The parallelism. Now, what is the parallel in reference to righteousness, justification, and life? What is that side of the parallel? What is the parallel on that side? It is simply this, that we are justified by the righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ, and nothing could be more obvious. Justified by the righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. And Paul is so insistent upon establishing the parallelism here that he calls the righteousness of Jesus Christ the one righteous act. Verse 18. The one righteous act, the one righteousness. And then in verse 19 he calls it the obedience of the one. So undoubtedly, it is the one righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. And what Paul is controverting, this part of the epistle, first five chapters of the epistle to Romans, what he is controverting is the doctrine that we are justified by our own works. That's the doctrine he's controverting. What is true on the other side of the parallel? What is it that provides the parallel in the case of Adam and Pushtad? What is it that provides it? Is it the actual sins of all men as the ground of condemnation? If it were the actual sins of all men, then that would be parallel to the very doctrine that the Apostle Paul is refuting. Parallel to the very doctrine he is refuting, namely, that men are justified by their own works. And so the only thesis that can provide the parallel to justification and life is the one sin of the one man, Adam, as the ground of the condemnation of death that has passed upon all men. I say the only power that can provide the analogy is the one sin of the one man, Adam, as the ground of condemnation of death. So you see, you have actual exegetical and theological consideration militating against the Pelagian exegesis, and therefore militating against the exegesis which is perhaps most current in Protestant circles today because of the influence of the dialectic theology. Well, so much for that's the refutation of the Pelagian. Now we come to the next interpretation of this passage of the last clause in verse 12, where Paul Patrick came out on. And this is the Roman Catholic. Now there, it is to be admitted that there was not unanimity in the history of the Roman Catholic Church on this question. There were two very notable Roman Catholic theologians at the time of the Reformation, at the time of the Council of Trent, who maintained the position that I think is the correct position. They were Catharinus and Pigius. C-A-T-H-E-R-I-M-U-S and P-I-G-H-I-U-S, Catharinus Antiguus. But nevertheless, the contentions of Catharinus Antiguus did not win the day in the Roman Catholic Church. And although there is a good deal of obscurity in the Roman Catholic dissertations on this question, into which I am not going to enter now, nevertheless, the classic Roman Catholic position, the preponderant Roman Catholic position, is that the Pater Immortal in Romans 5:12b, the Pater Immortal refers to habitual or original sin, which is transmitted to Adam's posterity by natural generation. Habitual original sin transmitted to Adam's posterity by natural generation. That term, according to the Roman Catholic construction, consists mainly in the privation of sanctity. The privation of sanctity. Now the Roman Catholic Church recognizes the relationship which that habitual sin sustains to the first sin of Adam. The Roman Catholic Church is quite clear on that point, that this privation of sanctity arises from this sin of Adam, Adam's prevarication, as it is called, in eating the forbidden fruit. But nevertheless, the sin that is passed on to posterity is the habitual sin, resulting from Adam's prevarication. Now this view will not end up either. There are exegetical and theological objections to this Roman Catholic view also. The first that I've mentioned is simply a presumptive argument which I don't regard as demonstrably conclusive, but which is presumptive, and I might call it a grammatical argument. The presumptive argument against it is that it is very difficult to reconcile this interpretation with the use of the historical theorist Hemart. Because this view refers to a certain condition which is perpetually being passed on from Adam to the whole human race by ordinary generation. And although it is not absolutely impossible, not absolutely impossible to think of the aorist tense in that connection, nevertheless, it would be quite abnormal. And what you would expect here is the perfect tense. The perfect tense, rather than the aorist tense, if that is exactly what Paul had in mind. Not that all sin, but that all have come to be sinful. And the perfect tense would be perfectly appropriate to express that idea. What have come to be sinful, because it would denote a present condition resultant upon a past action. And the perfect tense is admirably suited, whereas the aorist tense would not be, to say the very least, the most appropriate. However, there might be a way, which I don't want to discuss now, there might be a way whereby the aorist tense, or just call it a simple argument, but it is not something that is to be completely overlooked. Now the second argument against this Roman Catholic view is that it is quite contrary to the parallelism which is instituted in this passage. Quite contrary to the passage in connection with justification. You see, the central strand again of this passage is the analogy between Adam and Christ. Now, what is Paul's doctrine? With reference to justification, it is not that we are justified by having righteousness infused into us. We are not justified by being made subjectively holy through our relationship to Christ. We are justified by His once for all completed obedience, by His once for all accomplished righteousness. Now, of course, the Roman Catholic Church is not inconsistent at this point, because the Roman Catholic Church does believe that justification consists in regeneration and renovation. And so on the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification, the parallel would hold. The parallel between Adam and Christ would hold.
But the point now is that the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification is not false doctrine.
There isn't one syllable in this passage. There isn't one syllable in this passage suggesting the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification. Everything in this passage points to our justification by the one righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. Justification by the one righteousness or obedience of the one man, Jesus Christ. And therefore, again, as in connection with the Pelagian exegesis, the only parallel to that is that we have become condemned, that we are condemned and the heirs of death by the one sin of the one man, Adam. Now the third argument and refutation. The third argument and refutation is again the sustained emphasis of the passage in verses 15 through 19. The sustained emphasis of the passage. That condemnation has passed upon all. And that death comes to reign over all by the one sin of the one man. Verses 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. By the trespass of the one the men died. The judgment was from one unto condemnation. By the disobedience of the one, the many were constituted. Remember the five distinct instances which that very same principle is asserted. The disobedience of the one, the many were constituted. Remember the five distinct instances which that very same principle is asserted, and asserted in different forms in order to exclude all possibility of disagreement from the conclusion that it was by the one sin of the one man, Adam, that condemnation came passed upon all men, and that death came to exercise its sway upon him. Now, habitual sin, original sin transmission, can never be called the one sin of the one man. Surely that is not. Adam by his fall needed involved himself in habitual sin. He became sinful, he became depraved. But that depravity transmitted to posterity can never be called the one sin, the one Adam. And so you see the Roman Catholic interpretation.
We come to Calvin's interpretation, and Calvin's own interpretation. Exegetes exegetically speaking, Calvin's interpretation is identical with the Roman Catholic. Exegetically. His view of original sin is radically different. Rome construed original sin, habitual sin, as consisting very largely in the privation of sanctity. Whereas Calvin regarded original sin as radical depravity. Radical depravity. As consisting not simply in the loss of original righteousness, but the corruption of man's whole nature. I repeat, consisting not simply in the loss of original righteousness, but the corruption of his whole nature. And you must remember that a great deal of the polemic of the reformers on this question directed against the Roman Catholic view of original sin, habitual sin. The polemic of the Reformation, especially of Calvin and the Reformers, is to a very large extent focused on the refutation of the Roman Catholic doctrine. But nevertheless, exegetically speaking, Calvin's own interpretation of Romans 5:12b, that whole Catholic came out of, is in the same category as the Romanist interpretation, because he takes it as referring to original sin, to hereditary depravity. That in Adam all became sinful. And you'll find that in his commentary, of course, and you'll find it also in the Institute. You'll find it quite clearly stated in his commentary on Romans, but Paul distinctly affirms that sin is propagated to all who suffer its punishment, and this he afterwards more expressly declares when a little later he assigns the reason why all of Adam's posterity are subject to the dominion of death. Even this, he says, being that we all have sinned, but to sin is in this case to be corrupt and vicious. He just quoted Romans 5:12b, and that all sin, inasmuch as all sin, corneum omnes peccavimus, but to sin is in this case to be corrupt and vitiate. For that natural depravity which we bring from our mother's womb, though it does not immediately bring forth its fruit, is nevertheless sin in the sight of God and deserves his vengeance. And this is the sin which they call original. For so Adam at his first creation received both for himself and for posterity the gifts of divine favor, so by falling away from the Lord, he in himself corrupted, vitiated, depraved, and ruined our nature. Having been divested of God's likeness, he could not have begotten seed, but like himself. Therefore we all have sinned, because we have all been imbued with natural corruption, and so are become wicked and perverse. Now there's a total difference between the Calvin's conception of this perversity that we all derive from Adam, and the Roman Catholic conception of habitual sin, but you see, it is in the same category exegetically. Now, this had been an Augustinian tradition. An Augustinian tradition. The Roman Catholic Church followed that Augustinian tradition, but of course watered down the Augustinian conception of original sin. Calvin did not water down the Augustinian conception of original sin. But he did not get above or beyond the Augustinian tradition in the interpretation of this particular passage. And so the same argument must be pleaded against Calvin's own interpretation of this passage as pleaded against the Roman Catholic. And I don't need to repeat these, but they all apply. I would not urge the first presumptive argument with the same vigor or with the same term against Calvin's view as I would the Roman Catholic, because the way he puts it, you might possibly reconcile it with the English text. This is his own statement. By falling away from the Lord, that is Adam, by falling away from the Lord, he in himself corrupted, vitiated, depraved, and ruined our nature. It's possible that the English text could be used to express that fact. He's looking upon it as a once for all vitiated human nature, once for all, corrupted human nature, and that might be quite compatible with the use of the aorist tense. Now, of course, we come to the classic Protestant view of Romans 5:12b, the classic Protestant view. You see, we are still concerned with this clause in Romans 5:12b in that all sin. What does Paul mean? Now it is quite clear in verse 12, quite clear, that the universal reign of death rests upon the fact that all sin can't escape. No one disputes that. Couldn't be such a thing. And so death penetrated to all men in that all sins are on the ground of the fact that all sin. That's quite clear. And whatever may be contemplated in that Pantis Hematon, whatever it may be, it is the reason why death passed through to all men. But in verses 15 through 19, Paul says, listen, but more frequently, that the universal reign of death rests upon the one trespass of the one man, Adam.
the wonderful, wonderful wonder. I'm sure you have two indisputable statements. The universal reign of death rests upon the fact that all sin has its immortal. Likewise, that the universal reign of death rests upon the one purpose of the one man, Adam. What are we to do with that? Are we to suppose that Paul was dealing with two entirely different situations? And that in verse 12 is dealing with one situation, the explanation of which is simply that all sin, whereas in verses 15 through 19 he is dealing with an entirely different situation, which the explanation is the one sin of the one man Adam. Now, unless you are going to identify these two, unless you are going to identify the situation in verse 12 and the situation in verses 15 through 19 with which Paul is dealing, that is what you are bound to conclude, that he is dealing with different situations. Dealing with an entirely different truth complex. How is that possible? Is it possible for us that Paul has two entirely different situations of view in these two passages? One in verse 12 and another in verses 15 through 19. Is it possible? Well, that's the question I'm going to discuss right now. And I'm going to present to you because why we must hold those three forms, 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to present the reasons why we must hold that all is dealing with the same situation. The same truth complex. The same phase of God's government. And the first reason is this. But behold, passages of unit. Lowercase form of one. Behold, passages of unit. As I said repeatedly, the central strand is the parallelism.
The remaining part of the lecture was not recorded, so I shall play it into the tape myself from my notes. The last part of the lecture was Mr. Murray gave three reasons why we should hold to that position that says Paul is dealing with the same situation, the same truth complex, the same phase of God's government. Mr. Murray gave the first reason that the whole passage is a unit, and he said that repeatedly he had said that the central strand is parallelism. The central strand is the identity of the modus operandi. It is quite impossible to suppose that in verse 12 Paul is dealing with one phase of God's government, and in verses 15 through 17 he is dealing with another. He emphasizes the closely knit unit of the whole passage. The second reason is that not only is this passage a closely knit unit, But we must remember that in verse 12, that verse 12 is an unfinished comparison. If verse 12 were completed in the context of its own terms, its own, and if it were possible to think that there is a radical transition at the end of verse 12, or for that matter, at the end of verse 14, then it would be possible for us to think Paul is dealing with two distinct phases of God's government. This is, however, not possible, for we only know what the apotheosis of 12 would be if it were completed in its own terms from the apotheosis which we find in verses 15 through 19. In other words, Paul doesn't complete the comparison in verse 12 because he relies on the succeeding verses to supply the apotheosis which verse 12 would have required if completed. And the third reason is that Paul is dealing with the same phase of God's government. Verse 14 makes it impossible to interpret verse 12b, Pontus Hamartan, in any other terms than that which is unfolded later in verses 15 through 19. For verse 14 tells us that death reigned over those who did not sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. The reign of death in verse 14 is the same reign referred to in verse 12 when Paul says death penetrated or passed through to all men. So in verse 14, Paul is saying death passed on to and reigned over certain persons who did not voluntarily transgress as Adam did. The only reasonable inference is that the sin of Adam had implications for those whom death reigned over.